Log Talk Radio.
Ah, I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, let's let it roll. I wonder if people thought that was me saying, whoa! There he goes again!
I don't think you sound like a great soul singer.
No. I was told, actually, this is really interesting, and thank you for mentioning that. Susanna Breslin, who wrote a piece that we both quoted, and it was a really interesting piece.
Mm-hmm.
Now I forget what it was about. And she finally listened. Do you remember what it was about?
It was about her investigation of the porn world
right.
that she self-published.
Right, and how effective that was.
Yeah, and how effective self-publishing
right,
was. Right,
right. And so somehow she decided after, I think, having read my stuff for on and off for years, mm-hmm. that she would actually listen to one of our podcasts, and she was surprised. She said, you don't sound at all like you're writing. And I said, oh, really? You know, how do I sound? And she said, well, you sound like Jeff Bridges, Jeff Bridges,
uh-huh.
and sort of happy and whatever. I forget the thing, the way she put it. And I thought, man, that's one of the nicest things anybody's ever said to me. You know, like, this aggression will not stand. I don't know. Are you a Big Lebowski fan?
I like that movie.
Oh,
yeah.
Like it. You see,
Jeff Bridges is good to be compared to.
Totally.
You know who people have been telling me I sound like?
After
doing my videos?
No.
This has been multiple mentions, at least a dozen. Wallace Shawn.
I'm going to now show you how ignorant I am.
You don't know who Wallace Shawn
is? I don't know who Wallace
Shawn is. Did you ever see the movie My Dinner with Andre?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well, those who know him.
Okay.
And
I'll have to go see it, because I'm sure he's very intelligent and thoughtful and
he's actually the son of the legendary New Yorker editor William Shawn, he's a writer and he's also an actor, but he has a very funny, quirky voice. Anyway.
Funny and quirky, that works.
Yeah.
It tied the room together, dude.
He
peed on your carpet!
Let's get right. Rebooting the News number 76.
Yeah. By the way, this time I will try to play the music at the end again, as if I had been successful doing it last week, which I really wasn't.
Yeah.
We also had a fire drill last week. I think we should mention that.
Right. That was a real fire.
Actually, it was a real fire.
It wasn't a drill.
And we all had to evacuate, and I had to do the production in a Starbucks of all places.
Yeah.
Which was fine. And uh-huh. we're all safe, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
But
okay.
Similar could be said about WikiLeaks. This is not a drill.
No. Oh, good segue.
Mm-hmm.
Nice job. So what are we talking about today? WikiLeaks, perhaps?
Well, look, there's no escaping this, because this event with its tentacles keeps spreading out, and it is a kind of a reckoning with things that mm-hmm. have been building for quite a while, and they were always there, but
oh, yeah.
we couldn't see them.
Well, people weren't that interested in talking about them
right.
either.
Wasn't an urgency about it.
Right. I think this is like one of those moments. I was trying... Well, you take it. Where are we going first?
Well, I thought we would go to our conference that we were
yeah.
both at.
Oh,
because
yeah. What a great conference that
yeah,
was. Yeah,
we both were speakers at the Personal Democracy Forum's flash conference on WikiLeaks and Internet Freedom on Saturday in New York City. And a bunch of smart people, some of whom were on the podium, some of whom were in the quote-unquote audience, got together to kind of think this thing through. And one of the themes for me was what I just said, which is that this episode reveals things that have been there for a long time, but we weren't ready to see them, or it wasn't easy to spot them. And I thought all the speakers were good to great.
Yep.
And almost all the comments from the floor were dead on. There was a minimum of showboating. There was a sense of calm urgency
mm-hmm.
and clarity. And it was really a very impressive event.
It was a milestone. I've been talking about flash conferences for years, and I've never actually done one. Or been part of one. I don't think they're
Didn't
ever...
Didn't you write a post saying we need a flash
I've written
conference?
About this many times, and I've tried to get them to boot up when I was in California. But you know, unless you do one of these flash conferences, unless the issue is inherently long-lived or, people move on very quickly. And yeah. unless you do it, like, within a week, it just isn't happening. And so it's never actually come together. And to actually see this, actually, it worked probably largely because it was a flash conference, you know, because I wrote a post the day, I think it was actually on Saturday, called Moon Mission, and it's in these moments when people feel they're not busy, they're not too busy to think about things that they're ordinarily way too busy to think about. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm going to ask you to think, and I've done this, not you, but in general you, to think about where you're storing your web content, you know?
Right.
I've done that many times here on this show.
Yeah.
And it usually, you know, goes over like a lead balloon. You know, I don't want to worry about that. I got too many other things to deal with.
Right.
You do. I mean, not just you. Everybody does. I do, too. And, you know, I still use Twitter, you know, and... But now it comes right to the front, that now this is what I was talking about, is that when you hit this moment, you cannot trust these corporations to stand up for you as far as they can stand up. And I don't know what the government told Amazon. I don't know what Amazon's process was, how they made that. I have no clue. It was not transparent at all. What it really did focus people on, and now when I talk about this, people are paying attention. So I say, okay, now we can solve this problem, or we can move the ball forward at least.
By doing what?
Well, let me just harken back to how blogging started. And in 1996, there was a thing called the Communication Decency Act that was mm-hmm. passed by Congress, signed by the president, and what it did was very vague, but it very clearly gave the government authority to determine what the internet was used for. The pretense was to protect against pornography so that kids wouldn't be seeing pornography
protecting
on the internet.
Young.
Right? Yeah. But, you know, and so there was a large belief, and Clinton even sort of hinted at this, that he believed that this was unconstitutional, the courts would turn us down, blah, blah, blah. But he signed it anyway. You know, mm-hmm. he signed something that he personally believed was unconstitutional, which is the ultimate of hypocrisy. And
or triangulation.
Whatever. It's like, this is not what we hire a president to do, mm-hmm. in my opinion, okay? We hire a president, he swears his oath of office to uphold the Constitution, mm-hmm. right? It does not...
Let me just sign this to see if the courts don't return it.
Yeah, if yeah. they're paying attention or
right.
whatever.
Right.
Or maybe...
Let's see if they're paying attention over there at the Supreme Court.
Or let's see if it wasn't actually decided in the Supreme Court. It was just decided in a lower court. But what happened while it was still pending was there was this kind of attention, you know, from people who truly believed in the potential of the internet. And these were real true believers in those days, because the internet was vastly smaller than it is now. So the people who were actually paying attention at that point were there because they were the kind of people who are looking for stuff like this. And a lot of them were reporters, by the way, too. And librarians and programmers and, you know, early adopter types. And so I wanted to have, you know, I call it holding hands in cyberspace. I wrote a piece called A Billion Websites. These were all before this event happened. I said, okay, here's my opportunity. Now publishing, they're about to take this away from us. Now people will really want to do it. And so what we did was we set a target date, like it was a month in the future, and we said we were going to call it 24 Hours of Democracy. And in those 24 hours, you were going to be able to publish anything you wanted to, and we would figure out how to get that onto the web for you, and it was going to be accessible to everybody. If you wanted to write, we were going to make it accessible. And in that month, we pulled it off. It actually happened. There were thousands of essays written, some of them by very famous people, got a lot of attention. But what it did that had long-lasting value was it probably pushed up the development of blogging software by 2-3 years because of that moon mission mentality,
right.
that we were able to muster the resources and the permission. We got support from all kinds of places, plus the sense of urgency that mm-hmm. comes, the creative urgency that comes from knowing that on this day, these people are going to show up here, and we promised we'd publish their stuff for them.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, well, blogging software has gotten easier to use, but it's also drifted from that initial sort of, this is an exercise of democracy, that sort of seemed very idealistic, probably, you know.
Right.
You know, now it's not so idealistic anymore. Now it's very sort of pragmatic because you've actually had an event where, you know,
Doug Rushkoff spoke eloquently about this.
I thought, yeah, absolutely. I rewrote my whole talk when I heard what he said. Just said, I don't have to say it anymore because that was exactly what I was going to say. So then I took it the next step and I said, okay, you know, my tribe, the geeks, let's talk now. How many people are programmers here? A third of the people raised their hands. So we are attracting technical people here, but we're not, there wasn't any technical content to this conference. There was no, you know, and the same problem we're having with the tools, we're having with these conferences, with these meetups, that everything's focused on companies, corporations, commercialism, et cetera. The open formats and protocols get zero attention.
Right.
You go to hackathon, it's all corporations presenting their APIs and their job fairs, basically, and nothing is being done to enhance the freedom on the internet.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say, oh, pat you on the head and say, it's very nice, Dave. But I tell you what, eventually it's going to become an issue for the commercial companies, too. How do we guarantee that people have their freedoms within our environment? Because ultimately, if they don't feel that they have it, they're not going to use it.
Yeah.
You know.
I know I shouldn't be, but I'm still a little shocked at the way these companies behaved. I mean, I've assimilated already that, all right, they kicked WikiLeaks off of Amazon and the DNS company, you know, booted them. But it's not only that, it's that the fact that, for example, Bezos didn't feel the need to explain himself.
To say something himself, yeah.
That's another thing. That's not only are they failing to guarantee the open web, but they really don't even think they have to explain to us what happened.
No, that was a mistake. I think they'll come to regret that eventually. You play this thing out.
I would hope so. Because
no, they will. They will.
PayPal, did you see this event at LeWeb?
Yeah.
This vice president for PayPal comes out on stage.
Yeah.
Dave, he knows he's going to be asked about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
He sits down in front of all these web people. The first question is, I got to ask you about what's the deal with WikiLeaks. And he sits there in his chair and he lies. Either he lies or he's so uninformed as to be incompetent at his job.
Yeah. Wait, say what he said, though.
Okay, so they asked him, you know, how did this happen that PayPal stopped serving WikiLeaks? And the vice president, whose name I can't remember, sits in his chair and he explains that a letter came to PayPal from the State Department saying that WikiLeaks was engaged in illegal activity and that's a violation of our terms of service because we don't allow that.
Right.
And the letter, which was public at that point, didn't actually say that. What it said was the person who leaked the documents took them from classified sources and gave them to WikiLeaks was definitely guilty of a crime. But it didn't say anything about WikiLeaks being guilty of a crime, which is still a very dubious proposition. And as far as we know, there isn't any crime that they can be charged with so far. Although some people are asking to change the Espionage Act of 1917 to make it a crime. So what he said was wrong and couldn't possibly have been the reason that PayPal acted the way it did. Or if it was, it means that PayPal is completely incompetent. But to not be prepared and to give this, excuse the language, bullshit explanation in front of people who are prepared and can find the link to the letter in 13 seconds, it's just astounding to me that a company, you know, that makes its living off the internet could behave in this kind of way.
The tech industry has done this over and over. You know, the first really big example of this, they don't understand. I think what's happening here is they don't understand how much scrutiny they're under, how much attention is being paid to them.
Yeah.
Their view of the outside world isn't tuned in well enough to be able to pick up the increase in intensity. And my guess is that as a corporation, they had not discussed what to do when...
Well, this guy was way overconfident when he walked out.
Yeah.
Way overconfident.
I know. And, you know, there was a great example of this in the mid-90s where Intel had a problem with one of their processors, or their main processor, actually. It was a Pentium. And it was the one that was in all the computers everybody was buying. And it would, under some circumstances, make mistakes doing mathematics, doing real point arithmetic, floating point arithmetic. And when people found out about that, they were quite concerned about it. It's like, well, and it would, you could see it in Excel. You could demonstrate the bug in Excel. It showed up in the spreadsheet. And they said, well, you know, it's really not that big a deal. It just happens once in every blah, blah, blah. They give all the mathematics, all the engineering information, and people go, yes, and? You know, because they're not tuned into this probability stuff. I mean, I was reading it very carefully, and it said basically this will happen once every 5 light years, and or every 5 whatever, you know, huge
light
amount.
Years. Yeah.
It just, light years isn't the right number, right way of saying it.
Let's get our science right here.
I know. It's early in the
this
morning.
This is a
whatever.
University.
Right. Thank you. I just flunked my... it's good we can laugh about this, but...
But that's the behavior.
It just wouldn't happen very often. And yeah. And people didn't accept it, and they said, well, frankly, if we were going to indemnify you against any damages, it would be like we'd indemnify everybody with 5 cents or something. And that didn't go over very well. And finally, in the end, they had to pay hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars for a recall when just a little bit of careful PR probably would have taken care of the problem. Open up a rebate thing, you know, where anybody can return their chip if they want to, you know. Fine.
Right, but
Steve Jobs did it recently, yeah. too, with this IntelliGate thing. You know,
yes.
We're right, screw you.
Right.
Right? I mean, this sensitivity to maybe we need to treat these people like they matter a little bit, you know.
Well, you're cutting off a news provider on a controversial story of worldwide impact.
Yeah,
I want to hear from the CEO, and there's nobody else that I want to hear
Well, this
from.
Okay, came up in a piece that I wrote where I said, look, I'm not going to cut off. I'm not going to stop using Amazon. And a very good friend of mine, Matt Terenzio, posted a comment. And he's a systems guy who works at a small Connecticut newspaper. And he said, you know, I understand, you know, he does understand. Everybody, any tech guy understands. You can't just make this decision casually. You know, it would take me months to get off of Amazon. And he said, however, what this says is that you cannot use Amazon for journalism.
Right.
Can't do it. Because if they'll yank the plug... if just at the first sign of trouble,
right.
then you can't say that you have journalistic integrity because you're going to be factoring that in to your decision about whether or not you publish anything.
Right.
Is this going to get us in trouble with Amazon? And, you know, probably if Amazon were part of this discussion, they would say, oh, well, if you're a newspaper, then that's a different story. And then, well, we'd have to say, well, okay, I'm running a blog. What am I? Chopped
liver? That's why it was so inspiring that the French newspaper Libération decided to become itself a mirror site for WikiLeaks.
Really? I didn't know that.
You didn't. Mm. Libération, which is a center-left newspaper, the origins of this newspaper are in the French underground in World War II.
Wow.
And they decided last week, maybe it was like Thursday or Friday.
That's what we need, Jay.
To host a mirror site.
That is on my list. Okay, so I created a list of, and this is on my blog right now, on the top item, of what would be the characteristics of a foundation or a trust that would serve to store, publish and store our creative work and give us the best guarantee that you could possibly give. Obviously,
so that this wouldn't happen, what happened.
Well, you can't.
Happen.
If the government, you know, if you're, you know, there are things that nothing can protect you against, but
right.
it's pretty clear that Amazon, PayPal, and, you know, at all,
easy
MasterCard,
DNS.
No, it wasn't Easy DNS. That's the problem.
Oh.
That, you just did it.
Sorry, Easy DNS.
Yeah, right. That's the problem.
Every DNS.
Every DNS. That's just a little bit better than what those guys did. And this a lot of this thinking happened before, but some of it happened at the conference. I realized who would provide this service? Okay, that's the first question. And I always thought it would be a university plus a tech company or two or three of each, right, would form a foundation. The university for its long-livedness, for its lack of a commercial interest, For its ability to process an endowment, because that is how I would see
501c3
financed, yeah. And also the practice, understanding endowments. Corporations,
right.
Commercial corporations don't understand, they don't know how to manage an endowment.
Right.
And then I was thinking the tech industry, well, to provide the technical resources needed, but I don't think you can do it with the tech industry anymore. Not until they understand how serious this stuff is.
Which they don't.
Which they do not. And
leadership, pathetic.
Absolutely. And possibly this can be upgraded. So don't count it out forever. But it would be a university, library, foundation. And what I added this time was news organization.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't news organizations?
Yeah.
Clearly, this is part of their charter.
Liberation says so.
You see, what was really elegant about what you just said is that they figured that out, too, that this is part of a charter of a news organization.
Right.
Simply providing information to people who want it. It's a lot like a library, right? So it must be long-lived. I also thought of insurance companies, too, because they, by their nature, are long-lived. They make a guarantee, you know, and we do buy insurance, by the way. So it's not as if they can't be trusted. We've decided.
It would sort of be like insurance. It would be insurance for the web or insurance for the open net.
Yeah. Right. Well, it would actually turn into the infrastructure because anybody that did not store this stuff there would be crazy.
Yeah.
Be completely out of their minds, in my humble opinion. That it would use a least common denominator storage system that is accessible through HTTP. Least common denominator means that it operates with as much different software as you can possibly make it operate. And all of the protocols and formats have to be open, which means I can hear Howard Weaver asking me philosophically, well, what does open mean, you guys?
Mm-hmm.
Open means you can replace any component with anything you want.
Mm-hmm.
So that all what you're really doing at the end of the day is defining, blessing a certain set of protocols and saying this is how we're going to do it,
right.
And providing the service to back that up, but then saying you have total choice. If you think somebody else is doing a better job, please use them. And it has to cost money, cannot be free. We've really, really made this mistake by saying that it and Amazon should have been the last guys to choke on this. Because they charge money, that means they have a certain independence from your content. They're not aligned with you at all in terms of what you publish. Any more that somebody that operates a printing service bureau has any liability for what you print.
Right.
What you say is up to you.
Right.
His job is simply to print it. Okay,
right.
Amazon was in a perfect case. Twitter, much more complicated, and because they have clearly got an interest in the content on the site. Same with Facebook. They have taken a completely different position. And simplicity of user experience, because there's another tyranny in here you want to avoid. You want to avoid the techies getting in the way of acting as yet another filter on what people can talk about.
Right.
And they will do it. This is what we've seen, right? I mean, you know, if you can make it, if I can make it half as complicated by doing a little bit more work, we're going to do the work. So this is what I like to set in motion alongside these meetups that we have, Jay, so that we actually get some progress going, so we get some better services up.
Well, we've certainly seen the need for it. We couldn't have had a better demonstration.
Right.
It's impossible.
And the beauty of these times are that people are interested.
Yeah.
So.
Well, very. And everything that I have been writing and putting out, whether it's by Twitter, video, PressThink, over the last week or so, has just gotten a lot of recirculation and attention. And There's a public, a global public for this story,
which
is very exciting. If you wouldn't mind, I want to read the five tweets I used to organize my presentation. In a situation like this where you have 7 minutes, the way I do it now is I think of it as five tweets. I write them beforehand. I use them as my notes to talk from, and then I send them out as a summary. And it works because a certain number of people are there in the room, a certain number of people are listening by web over the simulcast, but then afterwards a lot of people receive the basic ideas through Twitter and I also put them at my blog. So These were the five ideas. It takes the world's first stateless news organization to show our news organizations how statist they are. Statist means they identify first with the fortunes of the state, not with civil society outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the sources are voting with their leaks. That they go to WikiLeaks rather than the newspapers says something about the newspapers.
What does it say about the newspapers?
That the sources don't believe they will have as much of an effect by going to the newspapers as they think they'll have by going to WikiLeaks. Three, the watchdog press died. More viable today is a distributed, quote-unquote, eye on power that includes the old press as one component part. I think for the journalistic profession, this is actually the most important thing that we've seen about WikiLeaks. It's the combination of the old press and some of its virtues and the new press and its virtues and the sources and the users all together in one big system. Just a small sign of that, The Guardian, which has been terrific on this story, as you might expect, created an account for the cables, and they said anybody who has a question about what's in the 250,000 cables, if it's a really good question, just tweet it to us and we'll look. We can't show them all to you right now, but we'll look and see if there's anything about that in the cables.
And then what? What have they promised to do? Have they actually responded to anybody on this?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was the editor of The Guardian who wrote a note that appeared in The Guardian live blog that said, if there's something you want us to look for.
I know. Maybe our listeners haven't heard about it. But it'd be interesting to see what the follow-through is on that, how they do that. You know.
But that's an example of the new system in action. So that's number three. The fourth was the state has a monopoly on the legal use of force, but it can have no monopoly on the legitimate use of digital force. A classic definition of the state is the entity that has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force, meaning only the state can come into your house and arrest you, and the state has a legal right to have the guns and shoot people who are enemies of the state. But in the digital realm, force is actually available to lots of players. And this creates a problem for the state that we don't actually know the resolution.
Kind of creates a problem for all of us, actually.
For all of us, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this
and
is...
We've seen it over the last 2 weeks.
This was one of the points of difference at the conference.
Yes, it was.
Whether or not a distributed denial of service attack is a legitimate thing or not.
Right. And whether it's civil disobedience or whether it's basically
funny how
criminal
the
behavior.
Techies seem to be agreeing on this one that it is not. That it's a bad thing, period. It is a bad thing.
Yeah. Right? There was a lot of disagreement, though. There was quite a few people who thought of it as civil disobedience there.
But you're shutting people up, and that's never a good idea. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel
as much as I don't like what they're saying, I still would like to hear it, you know. I'd like to have the choice, because I've seen people shut up too many times, and I don't see the harm in letting them talk.
Right.
You know, Amazon, too. I mean, what if Jeff Bezos wanted to get up and give a talk and explain what they were doing? There would probably be a lot of people who would want to shut him down and say, no, you don't get to do that.
Well, I wouldn't be with those people, that's for sure.
No, that's the point. That's probably, yeah.
My fifth was, everything a journalist learns that he cannot tell the public alienates him from that public. WikiLeaks tries to minimize this. This one needs a little bit of explanation, Dave. What I mean is, when journalists penetrate the secret world and they learn stuff on a confidential basis that they can't tell us, it begins to poison their relationship with us.
Yeah.
Because they see us making statements and objecting to stuff with limited knowledge. We don't have the knowledge they have. And they begin to see us as kind of out of it, ignorant children, people, you know,
that
naive,
they have to care for us.
That they have to care for us, right,
behalf.
Because they know things we don't.
This is where they get the idea that they're the public, which is something I object to, you know. It's like the
pretty
public
soon
and public
they're
relations.
Substituting themselves for the public.
Right.
Exactly.
But they don't understand as we know things they don't know, too. I mean, goes both ways.
It's harder for them to see that the more they...
Correct.
They
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And WikiLeaks, the terms of the contract that creates WikiLeaks with the sources are designed to prevent this in this sense. WikiLeaks doesn't know who the source is either. We don't know who the source is, but there's no difference between us and WikiLeaks on that score.
Mm-hmm.
And so you prevent this alienation from mm-hmm. happening. Anyway, that was my fifth point. So what I did was compose those things beforehand. Of course, as you said, they came out of what we've been talking about on this show and what I've been writing about for a while. So I was ready for this event. And then explicated them during my 7 minutes and then sent them out over Twitter.
You know, I just had a random thought. It's like, I wonder, not to do this now, but just plant a little seed. I wonder if you applied the same analysis to Wikipedia, what would the result be? That alienation thing. In other words, do they see a line between themselves and the rest of us? Pretty sure that they do, that there are structures in place that the Wikimedia Foundation, I think is what it's called,
mm-hmm.
Has separated themselves from the rest of us.
Well, they're becoming more professionalized, that's for sure.
Well, they also spend a lot of money it's difficult for me to say. Whenever this gets discussed in my sphere, somebody from within the inner circle of Wikimedia anonymously comes in and disrupts the conversation. So we never really get to the bottom of this, but how are they spending their money? Some people have said they only need $2.5 million to operate Wikipedia, yet they raise $20 million or whatever. You don't look like you like this idea.
I'm not sure I buy where you're going, but again,
I'm
don't have enough information
anywhere.
To
I'm
know.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm asking the question: is that how many of the institutions that we've created on the internet? I like what you're saying. Is that I like that facet of WikiLeaks. They have not tried to endow themselves with a special knowledge.
Right.
That requires a certain discipline that's good. It's sort of like Animal Farm, right, where they start off the revolution with the best of intentions, and then you gradually see that creep happen, where you have a class system comes into it, and now there are people who are more equal than others, right?
Right.
And, maybe...
Well, they've set up a possibility of that situation because they have the 250,000 cables. 2,000 of them
somebody's
have been
deciding
released.
Who, yeah, right.
They've been able to see all of them. We've been only able to see some of them.
So what's their process for that?
Well, their process has been basically outsourcing the verification and redaction of key cables to the news organizations.
Right.
And then running at WikiLeaks.org or the mirror sites those cables that have been quote-unquote
right.
cleared.
So they fully disclose everything to the news organization. Is
yes.
there just one news organization?
No, four or five.
But the Times is
the
not
Times
one of
did
them.
Not get the complete dump, but
right,
it was provided
right. we
by the Guardian.
Right, talked about that last week.
Guardian, El País in Spain... Der Spiegel, I think, and was it Le Monde? Yeah.
Well, I think these questions, I think that it's important because I don't want to turn my web content over to an organization that has built in knowledge that the rest of us don't have. That
right.
would be one of my criteria. In other words, I put together this list of, I think it's five things now. I think that we could codify that might be number six,
mm-hmm.
is that the organization is very limited in what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in a position to negotiate on behalf of us.
Right.
It is a very sort of lightweight thing that is just a trust. Its only purpose is to give us a shell that doesn't behave the way a corporation would behave or
right.
The way a government would behave, that it behaves in our interests. Our
right.
interest, and our interest is simply, we want to be able to speak. That's
yeah.
it. That's is that simple.
We want to be able to speak.
And have our stuff live. It
right.
has to exist for the indefinite future.
On the plane of just being a citizen, meaning we want to be able to speak with no other qualification required.
Correct.
Right.
That's right. You have an advantage because you're part of New York University, right? Your content is published. I assume that PressThink is run... No?
It is hosted by NYU.
It is hosted by NYU. Mm-hmm. And so if the government wanted to take that down, they would have to talk to NYU. And NYU, presumably, since you have academic freedom,
right,
would have to respect that, right? And then there probably would be ways... There certainly would be ways the government could convince them to have you take that down.
Yes. Some of the pressures that come on university attorneys are the same as in a big corporation.
Correct.
Trying to avoid lawsuits, et cetera.
But the society would respect the claim of the university that Jay Rosen has academic freedom.
The more central it is to academic freedom, to teaching and learning, the more strongly the university would resist.
Correct. Yeah. And we want, that's what we want. I want that without having to be a tenured faculty at a university that takes this stuff seriously.
Right.
I imagine there are universities that don't.
Correct.
Right. But a university that is very serious about this, that's where I want my stuff hosted.
Yeah. Let me just zero in on the point I was making about professional journalists. When they give, let's say, a Lewis Libby or a Karl Rove anonymity in order to speak through the news, which happened routinely, you know, under Bush, and continues to happen with, like, say, Rahm Emanuel or something they are making a kind of a bargain. They're signing away our right to know who's feeding them this information in the hopes that the information they get, the right to publish on, will be sort of greater public significance, right?
Yep.
So that's a bargain. It's a trade-off. If they're wrong, which is certainly possible, and the who told them this is more newsworthy than what they said, right? There is no way for us to review that. It's like a court without any appeal.
Correct. Yeah.
And if they consistently make a bad bargain for us, there's no way for us to know that either. So what's happened with the system of secrecy within journalism over time, and I wrote a post about this at my blog called Judy Miller, From Judy Miller to Julian Assange.
Right.
What's happened is that they've gotten themselves on the wrong side of secrecy through these transactions.
Yep.
And it's built up over a long period of time. But they now are so addicted to getting information this way, getting access, right? Getting exclusive information this way, that they don't see that there's kind of a revolt against that entire system out there. And you can't understand WikiLeaks without understanding that. Because if it was just a band of information warriors who worked for this organization, we wouldn't be in this situation. It's the fact that WikiLeaks has support beyond the members, whoever they are itself, that's creating this crisis, as it were. And I really think that there has been zero examination within the professional fraternity of journalists about this basic bargain with confidential sources, and zero reflection on how the press got itself on the wrong side of secrecy, which is why I wrote that piece at my blog. So I just wanted to explain that.
So as a professor of journalism, let's say, you know how we always talk that the rebooted news system, we're living in it, right? And so it's wrong to think about the future, you know, having a different kind of journalism, that we're actually seeing it now. I mean, so clearly, you know, everything that you just said to me as I'm listening to it, I'm thinking, yeah, this is all part of the, you know, the mathematics of the rebooted news system. I mean, it's so, let's say, on a scale of 1 to 100, okay, where 100 is we're fully rebooted and the old system is now, like, vestigial at best. In other words, practice the way, you know, blacksmithing is practiced. Mm-hmm. And somebody is still, you know, putting horseshoes on horses the old-fashioned way just because they like doing it, right? Mm-hmm. So, and one is, you know, 1945, mm-hmm. before there's been any internet or anything like that. So how far along are we, and how much did WikiLeaks move the bar? In other words,
I understand what you're asking.
You don't have to answer it. I think it sort of almost is You know, just asking the question.
It's good enough.
Yeah, pretty much. In other words, it was probably a significant delta.
Yes.
Yeah, something happened here. It definitely revealed, and I mean, I think that that's all I want to say about that. Yeah. I finally ran out of things to say, Jay. That's a milestone.
What I think is clear is that a more collaborative and cooperative news system is emerging, in which not only do big news organizations collaborate with each other, which they are doing here, but they collaborate with these activist organizations,
yep,
like WikiLeaks, yep, which resemble much more a Greenpeace or a human rights organization than a traditional news organization. And they collaborate with the users, and they face common threats. You know, the system that brought down WikiLeaks is a common threat to WikiLeaks and the news business, whether business sees it at or not.
Right. That's what Matt Terenzio was saying, that you can't host journalism on Amazon anymore. That's very clear. Yeah.
Which Newsweek?
Well, no, they're in denial.
Does,
on
for
it.
Example,
you know, Adrian sent out an email asking us to watch Howard Kurtz this week.
I watched it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And you know, what I saw was a group of journalists. I don't know if you can even call him a journalist, because he's not trying to find the truth. He's trying to. I don't know what I mean. He's a.
It was a very thin performance.
Yeah. And it was like, we know this guy has ulterior motives. And how do we know that?
I don't know what his motives are, but it was just a thin show.
Right. No, I don't mean Howard Kurtz.
Oh.
Howard Kurtz said that of Assange.
Yes, right.
And it was not challenged by anybody
right there.
There was no evidence that Assange has any other motives other than the motives of a journalist.
Well, this whole thing of we don't know what his motives are, I don't really understand that line of questioning at all. I mean, whose heart can we look into? You know what I mean?
Like, right.
Really, what you have to judge is.
But yeah, Howard Kurtz felt Rush Limbaugh had the maximum integrity. He couldn't possibly be influenced by the fact that he's going to make $2 million from this tax bill.
More serious than that was, he had on a journalist from the Washington Examiner, who said something on the air that was totally false. Glenn Greenwald's been battling against this particular thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That WikiLeaks was engaged in the indiscriminate dumping of the cables.
And that was the difference between what he was doing and what journalists would do.
Right. And that is completely wrong.
False, yeah.
It's based on almost zero inspection of what's actually going on here.
Yeah.
And WikiLeaks is not engaged in the indiscriminate dumping of documents, but the power of that story for professional journalists is so strong because they see it as such a good differentiator between what they do and what this upstart organization does, that they just use it whether it's true or not, which is the opposite of what journalism is supposed to be.
This is not journalism anymore. I mean, we're not in journalism land here.
It's ideological.
Yeah.
Completely ideological, where the ideology is not left-right, but pro-amateur.
This is what got me into blogging in the first place. They were writing all the time, there's no Mac, no new Mac software. Yet they were using all the new Mac software. They knew all about it. But yet when they wrote in their newspapers and their weeklies and later in their websites that there was no new Mac software, you'd ask them, don't you know about
seconds.
The new Mac software? Oh, yeah.
And you know, when you started revolting against the tech press, whenever that was back then, you started on the road to meeting up with me later on. Whatever exit you took, you know, intersected with whatever route I was on at the time.
Yeah, didn't win me a lot of friends. I'm sure same has happened for you. It's where we're headed.
I do okay.
Yeah, all right, exactly. Right, you can't be friends. Oh, wait. How many seconds we got?
We got a minute left.
Do we? Hold on. I got to get this thing queued
up.
This is like open source production here.
As
this
in
is like
spirit of 76.
You get to see it like we all get to see it. Okay, everybody. We're out of here. James Brown's going to take us out.
Dave, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Jay. So nice. So nice. I got you.
10 seconds.